Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to New Books in Sociology, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Rituparna, and today I'm going to be in conversation with Hemjyoti Medhi. Hemjyoti Medhi is an associate professor at the Department of English, Tejpur University. She coordinated a project under the CEFIS program, International Institute of Social History, Amsterdam, to create a digital archive of select Mahila Samitis in Assam, and has been working to take these stories to a larger audience through publication, exhibitions, media, and a short documentary film, Hetu Monot Ase, which can be translated into English as That I Remember. She's the author of the book Gendered Publics, Chandraprabha Saikiani, and the Mahila Samitis in Colonial Assam, which has been published by the Oxford University Press in 2023. Hemjyoti, I welcome you to the podcast. Thank you so much for giving me the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let me begin by asking you to talk a little bit about the context in which this book is written.
Okay, it's a long story because it began more than a decade ago. When I had passed my MA, slightly after that, in 2001, we were celebrating Chandraprabha Saikiani's birth, you know, centenary in Assam, across Assam, different Mahila Samitis, organizations. And I had already read Nirupama Borgohai's novel, Obhijatri, which is based on Chandraprabha Saikiani's life. And after all the celebrations in 2001, I had lots of questions and I wanted to know. So I was reading, you know, whatever biographies or essays or newspaper medals, mostly in Oxomia, that were available about her. And I realized that this was a vast area that remained relatively unexplored. You know, there was an entire oeuvre that needed to be discovered and documented and preservation. So it took me a while to make it part of my academic project. And after a few years, I registered for a PhD under supervision of Professor Rimli Bhattacharya, University of Delhi. And so this PhD, plus the archive that you've mentioned, you know, Memory Movement and the Mohila Committee in Assam, India, that archive project funded by the CEFIS program, International Institute of Social History, Amsterdam, both these contributed and they are in a way the foundation of the book. Now, why a book on the Mahila Samitis? Because the current Mahila Samitis in Assam is not really in the forefront of shaping the public discourse, except for a few one like the one in Tejpur, perhaps. So I felt that it was important for us to recover and record moments which are transformative, which I believe were transformative of the Oxomia public sphere in colonial times. So the book is in a way going back 100 years in that distant past to those radical and subversive moments, in an attempt to look forward and hopefully shape a future by taking cues from the progressive principles of those moments, you know, of 100 years back.
Right. Let me ask you about the methods that you have used in your book. What are the methodological tools and approaches that guide this work?
That's a very interesting question and also a little complex because, you know, this is more like a historical research and I'm a student of literature. So my training is in reading and I like to believe that there is no one specific method that I could follow because the terrain was in a way demanded that I approach it through multiple disciplinary perspectives. So the book, I believe, is an example of an interdisciplinary research where, you know, the colonial office official archive kind of is juxtaposed with the memory work of older women. So what we have is like the conventional historical sources, you know, of the British Colonial Archive, which is in the National Archive and elsewhere, mostly written in English, juxtaposed with Mohila Committee papers, you know, and handwritten minutes and proceedings of the Mohila Committees, which were preserved as part of the archive that we created. And these were further nuanced by what I like to call women's memory work, which were recorded as part of an oral history methodology that I follow in this work. And these are further substantiated by extensive consultation of newspapers such as Ohomia, Tindinia Ohomia, periodicals such as Bahi, Abahan, Gharjyoti, and these facilitated an absorption of you know, the milieu of the public sphere in the Brahmaputra Valley of those times. And last but not the least, I have used performative and expressive traditions like Naam Kirtan, which is a singing of Naams in the Vaishnava Namghar, and the Hippini Bharal, the weaving cooperatives. Now, I felt that, you know, when we talk about decolonizing, quote unquote, decolonizing methods, these performative and expressive traditions paved the way to understand living traditions by which women continued to, you know, practice in the Brahmaputra Valley even today, for instance. Yeah, so I would suggest that there are multiple methodologies that are involved in the book because of the nature of the project itself. Yes.
Right, and that is very interesting. I would want to know more from you about understanding the idea of the public sphere in Assam, particularly because of the region's specific relationship with colonialism.
Yes, I mean, that's a very interesting point, you know, because first of all, when I talk about the Ohomia public sphere, what would be the term for public sphere in Assamese, right? Because those of us who are engaged in research, we're also constantly trying to conceptualize ideas from our own context. And Uday Kumar has a very good argument about this, about, you know, naming of the public and how the naming itself is an exercise in self-visibility. He's, of course, talking about 20th century Travancore. But I take cues from that, and I realize that the closest that the Ohomia, that I think public sphere would come to is the Ohomia term rise, you know. So we know about the 19th century rise mill, you know, people's meeting, which were extensively crushed by the colonial powers. People were shot and they died. Then even in our contemporary times, we know, you know, when we speak in meetings, for instance, we say Shraddha rise, you know, in Ohomia meetings. So rise, I would think of conceptually in the context of Assam, that public sphere would be a combination of, you know, permutation and combination of this playing around with the idea of the rise. Now to talk about our colonial, you know, baggage, so to say, now, one of the salient features of the public sphere, the idea of the public sphere in Assam, both in the colonial period as well as in, you know, contemporary times, and because of our legacy, of course, that we know that until 1874, parts of modern Assam was part of Bengal Presidency, right? And between 1874 and 1912, there was a chief commissionership that was established. And 1912 onwards, it was again part of the province of Eastern Bengal and Assam. Now, these administrative exercises, we believe, left indelible marks, and, you know, both real and imagined, on the love-hate relationship between Ohomia and Bengali. You know, so on the one hand, there was a huge appreciation for Bengali language, literature, culture, and on the other hand, there was this opposition. And I do talk about it in the first chapter a little. And thirdly, and this is, I think, the most important and something that I have not really explored in detail, because this is not really part of what the book wants to do, that the public sphere in Assam is nuanced by the presence of diverse group of indigenous communities, you know, or political terms, tribal communities, with their own respective languages, literatures, and cultures. So in the introduction, I do gesture towards this multiplicity of publics, but as I mentioned, because the focus is on the Mohila committee and my limitations, because I do not really speak or read or write Karbi, Boro, Mishing, the book doesn't really delve or go detail into that. But I would really look forward to works which could substantially engage with, you know, one of these or many of these and rethink the public sphere in colonial Assam. Yes.
Right. So what is the relationship between the colonial public sphere and gender, particularly in the context of Assam?
Yes. So if we think of research in this area, right, I mean, general in South Asia, Partha Chatterjee's work on the nationalist resolution to the women's question is one thread of work where he argued, and which is a valid argument, that the nationalists resolve the women's question by creating this dichotomy or the binary between the home and the world, and the public and the you know, private, and these were marked along gender lines. So men in the domain of the public and women were thrust into the domain of the private or the home. Later, after Chatterjee, Mrinalini Sinha, in her very important work, has argued that this binary of man-woman and public, private, and world and home actually neglects the or negates the agency of women in the outer world of nationalist politics. And her work is mostly, you know, related to nationalist politics and how women shape the agendas, some of these agendas. So I this book, The Gendered Publics, is an extension of the argument that Sinha makes, but there are also important disjunctions. For instance, I argue that Chandraprabha Hoikiani and the Mohila committees in colonial Assam challenged some of the fundamental premises of the colonial public. And the one example that I love talking about is the Sarda Act controversy in 1934, when the Assam Mohila Samiti served a legal notice to a groom citing the Sarda Act to stop a marriage in Guwahati. You know, I can come back to this, you know, talking about this in detail in later. Yes.
Right. Let me ask you about how the Mahila Samitis challenge the gendered character of the colonial public sphere. And since you have worked on it, if you could give a few examples to talk about this.
Yeah, in fact, you know, from our contemporary times, the Mahila Samitis are often seen as very strictly middle class, non-controversial, appropriate role for women to work, etc., etc. And I was surprised to see that they actually had in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, there were nicknames for the Mohila committees. The two nicknames that stand out, one is Bia Bhanga Committee, which literally means associations that break marriages, I mean, even before they're being held. And Poharir Mel, you know, Pohari is actually literally petty shopkeeper or fisherwoman. And Poharir Mel has a connotation of, you know, like petty gossip and fisherwoman's gossip. Now, so the question that I had in mind is that if the Mohila committees were so, you know, after all, doing respectable women's social work in the public domain, why did they have, you know, these nicknames being, you know, called into, like Bia Bhanga Hamiti or Puhari Mel? So when finally I read this report, and this is in the Ahomya Weekly, which was a weekly newspaper published in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. And on 3rd March 1934, this is, you know, available in microfilm version in the Nehru Memorial Museum and Library, the newspaper. And while I was going through in order to understand, you know, the public sphere of the time, I came across, and it was sure, you know, we are all of us who have worked in archives, we know the serendipity of archives, right? And I was so elated to find that there was this report which said Sarda Ainor Dohai Di Bibahor Protirod Guwahatid Bikham Sanchalyo, which roughly translates as opposition to marriage, citing the Sarda Act, great sensation in Guwahati. So the report mentioned that Assam Mohila Committee delegation had visited this particular girl whose marriage it was Mini Goswami, who was 12 years old, and they had visited Mini's family, and they requested them that do not go ahead with the marriage because she is less than 14 years old, and according to the Sarda Act, so that child marriage restraint act passed in 1929, the marriageable act for girls is raised to 14. So the family didn't really give them a favorable reply. So what the samiti actually did is that they hired a lawyer, and the then Assam Mohila Samiti secretary Rajabala Das sent a letter to the groom threatening legal action. So, she said, if you go ahead with this marriage, the Assam Mahila Samiti has hired a lawyer, et cetera, et cetera. And they felt so threatened that they actually didn't come for the Jurun, which was scheduled on 28th of February, 1934. And this was reported in the paper. Now, in Assam, we know that the Jurun, which usually occurs between the actual marriage, is almost as important as the marriage. And when the groom's family didn't turn up for Jurun, the bride's family and major political leaders of those days, like Congress leaders like Vishnu Ram Medhi, Bhuvaneshwar Borua, Omiya Kumar Das, all pressurized heavily the Assam Mahila Samiti to withdraw this legal notice. And what they said is that please don't go by the quote-unquote legal method, but use the social method, meaning that you try and convince people not to get girls married, etc., etc. Now, in colonial, there has been extensive work on women and law in colonial India. I'm thinking of Ratna Kapoor and Brenda Crossman's work. There is, so many others. So Kapoor and Crossman have actually talked about, that we need to be wary of the binary discourse about law that talks about law either as a tool of social reform or as a tool of patriarchy. And they have warned us already about this. And there is a lot of scholarship, feminist scholarship in India, which talks about the Sarda Act. For instance, Mrinalini Sinha has written about it. And then Geraldine Forbes has written about it, that as an act, the Sarda Act actually had major limitations, and the colonial powers were not really interested in the fate of the young girls, but they were more interested in or busy in placating, the fears of the conservative sections of, and in fact, there are reports which suggest that many young girls were married when in between the time when the bill was introduced and the bill was passed. So the actual passing happened in 1928, but it came into effect in 1929. And we all know that there and actually extensive research that people got them married before the young girls, before the act actually came into place. So the Assam Mahila Samiti's action in this regard, I like to argue that there's a difference between a sophisticated understanding of the act, in our feminist reading and retrospective reading, both by the women's group of that, women's movement at that time and later feminist scholars, and women's groups actually challenging and threatening a marriage by serving a legal notice, which made the entire Guwahati urban public sphere go into a tizzy, so much so that major political leaders were called upon by the bride's family to intervene. So this exposes that there is a subversive potential of the legal that has been unleashed by the Assam Mahila Samiti. And that was something that could not be easily contained unless and until they themselves withdrew. Now, of course, there's a possibility that we could see the Mahila Samiti's activism and read it as kind of a naive and not the fact that they perhaps did not recognize the power that this law granted to the colonial authority over the bodies of the female subject. But the hectic kind of rescheduling that happened and the Assam Mahila Samiti stepping away at the last moment actually indicates, and they of course suggested that we are withdrawing this time because the notice period was short, but we are creating many SARDAIC committees across Mahila Samitis in Assam, and we are taking this up seriously. So this was a moment when the Mahila Samiti stepped out of the quote-unquote respectable middle-class mobilization of women and how threatened the contemporary urban elite felt, you know, and there are other examples. I'm sure those would, you know, come up as we go on to discuss.
Right. And thank you, Hemjyoti, for that response. Let me ask you now about the role of Chandraprabha Saikiani in these Mahila Samitis, because, you know, the book is also about her.
Yes, I mean, I was fascinated by her life, and I felt that this person was born in a village in, you know, Western Assam in Doihingri, a village called Doihingri in Bojali area of Kamrup district in 1901, who belonged to a lower caste, the Hut Boria caste, which are marked as lower castes, but was the family, the father was a village headman, Gaumburha. So they had landed property and they were relatively well off, but in terms of caste markers, they were not really on the higher echelons. So, she and the family, of course, both she and her sisters were sent to this oldest, one of the oldest girls' school in the Brahmaputra Valley, the American Baptist Mission School in Naugaon, and where she studied and completed junior and senior training. And there itself, she started the first Mohila Committee along with Khogendra Priya, Khogendri Priya Borwani in 1917. And when she came to Tejpur, and in fact, in her unpublished memoir, which is still handwritten, and we're trying to compile it into Rasunawali, she wrote that Tejpur lo ahimata puhor palo. I found light in Tejpur. So when she came and joined Tejpur as the headmistress of the girls' middle vernacular school, she again established a Mohila committee here with Kiranmoy Agarwala. And Kiranmoy Agarwala, of course, many people would recognize her son, Jyoti Prakhar Agarwala, who is celebrated as one of the doyens of cultural icons in Assam. So she stayed in Tejpur till about 1922. And while she was very, very active in the public and social life, she attended meetings and addressed, you know, the Assam Association meeting in 1920, where Prafulla Chandra Rai was the president, and many other meetings. So she was really becoming a major female public figure. And she had a relationship with a fellow literateur, Dondinath Kolita, and she became pregnant. So in April 1922, she resigned from her job, and in August, so she left the Tejpur and she went back home. And in August, she gave birth to this boy who was named Otul Hoikia. And she lived as a single woman with parental support. I believe the family was ostracized temporarily from the village, obviously for reasons of being an unwed mother, because she had given birth to a child outside of marriage. Though it is believed that she continued to have a cordial relationship with Dondinath Kolita, he went ahead and married someone else and then lived a family life, though both the families seem to have had a cordial relationship later on. Now, while in Doihingri, she was invited to a neighboring village, Kaljarapar, to establish a female school. And from there, she started teaching in a girls' school, then started trying to mobilize women. In 1925, in fact, there's this very interesting event that happened during the Assam Sahitya Sabha Association conference in Naugaon. And Chandraprabha Saikiani was already publishing, and you know, in 1921, in fact, she had written this very controversial essay called Bharator Nari Hikha, where she actually talks about female sexuality in a way that which is almost unimaginable for an unwed woman even today, about kam bhog, fulfillment of sexual desire. So 1925, she's on the stage of the Assam Sahitya Sabha meeting in Nogaon, and the tradition was that women were being seated outside, separately behind bamboo chicks. And she invoked these women that, what are you doing sitting behind bamboo chicks like caged animals? Why don't you break them open? It's a new age, etc., etc. And the women actually broke those chicks open. And Hoikany was hoping to establish an Assam Mahila Samiti, at a provincial level at that time. But as you can well imagine, if the women did that, then there were not too many supporters for them in Nogaon. So the Assam Mahila Samiti got sabotaged. So only in 1926, at the provincial level, with Chandraprabha Hoikany as the secretary, the provincial Assam Mahila Samiti was established in the Dhubri session of the Assam Sahitya Sabha. And she continued to be associated with the Mohila Committee for the next 5-6 decades of her life. The initial part, while she was a secretary, she also used to draw a salary as a touring clerk, because she had to go, and Amarjyoti Chaudhary has talked about it, about Chandraprabha Hoikany visiting his grandmother in Dibrugarh, the grandmother also being associated with the Mohila Committee, and how Hoikany would travel through different modes of transport, bullock carts, trains, steamers, buses, and very long walks. In fact, in order to curtail some of this difficulty, the family with whom she was staying in Kaljriapar, Gopinath Medhi, it seems they had the person was a cycle assembler, and he had assembled and customized a cycle for her, bicycle for her. And she's often, she's written it herself, and she's claimed to be the first woman bicycle, woman in Assam to ride a bicycle. And she's very proud of it. She talks about it in the, Jail Kahini memoir in great detail. So, lived, of course, so my question was, how was it possible for her, even, who was already an unwed mother? Otul Hoikya must have been about 3-4 years old when she was the secretary, she was made the secretary of the Assam Mahila Samiti. How was it possible for someone like her to create that space, carve that space for herself? I believe it was, and I talked to Swarnaprabha Mohanta, that, did people not ostracize her? Were not? So Mohanta said a very interesting thing, that dukhe gune manu, vice and virtue make a man. So that jar gun besita dukh kati jay, those who are more virtuous, you overlook their limitations they have. So it's a fascinating life that she lived, 1920s, being a single mother and writing extensively. I'll come to some of her writings later on if we have time. Yes.
Well, whatever you said was very enlightening, because I got to know so much more about Chandraprabha Hoikany. Although I have an interest in the public sphere and have read about her, but I was not aware of the fact that she very proudly claims to be the first woman bicycler from Assam. So that's something new. Let me also ask you about the experiences of the relationship with parallel sanghas, samitis, and sabhas, and what they reveal about the potential of women's associations.
Yes, that's a very interesting question. And because, both of us are interested in public sphere, and there is an increasing I'm very glad that a lot of people are now exploring, vernacular public spheres, particularly in South Asia, because it has so many layers. Now, the association with parallel Sabha Samiti question is very interesting, because like I mentioned, the initial meetings of the Assam Mahila Committee was actually being held in the venue of the Assam Sahitya Sabha. So in a way, the Assam Sahitya Sabha actively patronized, supported, and galvanized the Assam Mahila Samiti in the initial years. And there was no doubt, 1927. So 1925, Chandraprabha Hakyani calls the women for a separate thing. Then 1926, Dhubri Assam Sahitya Sabha meeting, which is when they established the Assam Mahila Committee. 1927, the Gwalpara conference of the Assam Sahitya Sabha is also the first annual conference of the Assam Mahila Committee. The second conference of the Assam Mahila Committee, Jorhat, 1929 March, is also the Assam Sahitya Sabha venue. Then the third conference, annual conference in Golaghat, 1929 December, same Assam Sahitya Sabha. So the Assam Sahitya Sabha, in a way, in the initial years, really and truly patronized, and some of the members like Venudhar Harma and others are very, actively supportive of the Mohila Committee. Now, the interesting part of it is that, and Tanika Sarkar has talked about it in the context of Bengal, that support and patronage often comes with conditions. And they're conditions that we are supposed to fulfill if we are being patronized and supported. And all this support that I have mentioned for nearly 7-8 years, because 1930 onwards, because of the civil disobedience movement for two, three years, the Mohila Committees didn't have regular annual conferences. And in between 1933 and 37, again, some of the annual conferences were held with Assam Sahitya Sabha, some were held without Assam Sahitya Sabha. Despite this very long association with Assam Sahitya Sabha, I would like to cite a particular a moment when you actually have this situation where one of the essays published in the Assam Sahitya Sabha Patrika was not just critical, but almost satirical about the Mohila Committee women. Now, what was it that they were so satirical about? Is that Ratnakumari Rajkhwani, who was the president of the Welcome Committee of the Jorhat March 1929 Assam Mohila Committee, had said something like this. I'll just quote, she says, I quote, "The son and the daughter derive sustenance from the breast milk of the same mother. They play and grow up under the same roof. They breathe the same air. Yet, according to Hindu Shastras, a daughter cannot inherit even a single paisa, even though the father is extremely rich," unquote. So of course, she's talking about equal inheritance and inheritance for both daughter and son. Now, there was an essay in Ronald Bhattacharya published shortly thereafter, after this speech, where she talks about against Parda, where she talks about the, offers a critique of patriarchy. And Budhirajan Bhattacharya actually attacks Ratnaprabha Rajkhwani and the Mohila Committee. And he calls them Tirir Jagoran. Now, we know that in Assamese, the term woman would be roughly translated as Mohila, Nari, or Tiruta. Now, Tiri is, of course, a disparaging way of calling somebody. So what I'm trying to suggest is that the same institution or association that have been so formative for the Mohila Committee's foundation as well as spread and extensive celebration through the annual conferences would, in their own journal, publish essays which should call the Mohila Committee Tirir Jagoran and also Udongya Guru and so on and so forth. And Chandraprabha Hakyani, of course, would not sit quiet, and she gave them back, etc. So it was a very, very contested space, which is why I feel that it's important for us to talk about gendering publics, because women were out there shaping the discourse in the public sphere, and they were because they were making a difference, they were under constant threat and challenge. Right.
So could you talk more about how one can map alternative understandings of the public through a gendered prism?
Yes, I mean, in fact, to continue with the discussion with the last question, for instance, when you think of the public sphere, gender becomes a very important marker of being in public. Now, gender here, of course, doesn't mean just men and women. It can be non-binary, transgender, right? And we are immediately identified by those markers. So to give another example, Lakshminad Bejbura, who is often called the Hahitarathi, the charioteer of our literature, who wrote extensively, wrote this very satirical essay. So in fact, not just Bhujinaran Bhattacharya, even major writers didn't hesitate to write satirically about women. And he wrote this essay where he talks about, this is in October 1929 in the periodical Bahi, which is his own publication. And he talks about Bhaktita Diya Mohila, and he creates this satirical image of a woman who goes on speaking in public. And I must of course mention here that in his own life writing, he has been he's been full of praise of Dibrugarh Mohila Samiti and Sipsagarh Mohila Samiti. And he actually mentioned Jogoda Devi as a very, very able public speaker, as a female able public speaker. But this is interesting because in his satirical essay, he talks about Bhaktita Diya Mohila as a kind of a satirical figure. And he is invoking a moment from Prafulla Bala Devi Chodhurani's presidential address in the March 1929 Jorhat Annual Conference, the same conference where Ratna Kumari Rajkhuani spoke. Now, so I'll just quote Lakshminad Bejbarua's writing, and then we'll see how it kind of tries to satirize Prafulla Bala Devi Chodhurani. So he writes, and I quote, you meaning women, will wear pants, shirts, play football, become a barrister, magistrate, lawyer, judge, and attend offices. And we, meaning men, with great pleasure shall stay at home to rear our children, feed them. We shall cook. You just provide us with the firewood, unquote. So this is Lakshminad Bejbarua writing this satirical essay about women who can go and speak in the public and become magistrate, lawyer, because women are demanding space. The Jorhat 1929 March conference was particularly controversial because both Ratna Kumari Rajkhuani made a powerful statement, as well as Prafulla Bala Devi Chodhurani, who was the president of the conference. Now, this last bit, we shall cook, you just provide us with the firewood, echoes a part of Prafulla Bala Devi Chodhurani's presidential address, where she had added, cooking is our duty and we shall continue to cook and weave in the loom. Why do you, meaning men, shy away from getting firewood and doing farm work? Nobody ever raises that question, unquote. So what you see is that while it is through a satirical essay that Bejbarua is making fun of these women public speaker, women who are demanding more space in the municipality boards, et cetera, because that is what some of the conference minutes suggested. It also indicates how the discourse of the public were being, the contours of this discourse was being changed by the participation of women. And the female public speaker as a satirical figure alerts us that an alternative understanding of the public is possible through gendered prism. The second thing that I'd like to mention is about performances. For instance, Chashme Noorjahan Begum, who was the secretary of the Tinsukia Mohila Samiti for a very long time, they performed a play called Kopu Kori. This is again 1934. Several other plays across Assam, so for instance, Tezpur Mohila Samiti performed Bakhantir Obhishek to raise money for Amrita Amrit Kaur's, Rajkumari Amrit Kaur's malaria fund for Sri Lanka. Then so some of these performances, of course, were without controversies, and they had euphemisms like they wouldn't call it natak because theater would, raise eyebrows. So they would call it drishabriti, or, they would have euphemisms. But some of these were not so easily accepted. For instance, in same 1934, when there was a play called Kalyani, Otul Chandra Hajarika's play, Kalyani was performed in Guwahati. There was a again, series of letters in Ahomya and Tindinia Ahomya newspapers attacking these women for bringing out young girl and trying to ape Bengali culture and trying to do the culture. So it was a public sphere that the women were shaping, and people were taking note of it. So the space that we have today, in a way, we are thankful to some of these transformative acts that our foremothers had, you know, shaped for us. There's also this very interesting example of the Tejpur Mohila Committee, you know, in 1948, and I have written about it in an article already, and it's also in the book, where the Mohila Committee actually suggest that there should be fixed meal times. And, you know, they suggest that all over Assam, they would like to start this movement, because nowadays women who are busy at home, they do not have enough leisure for the practice of culture, Kristir Bikahar Babe. And what they suggest is that meals should be fixed at you know, meal time should be fixed, lunch at 12 o'clock, you know, afternoon tea at 4 and dinner at 10 and so on and so forth. So that, and that's the basic reason, that women have more leisure for the practice of culture. Now, we know about the 1947 document about women's role in the planned economy, which talks about women's work and women's labor across class. But even that document places women's work, particularly middle-class women's work, in the domain of the domestic. And the domestic is seen as more of cooking and reproductive work, and is separated from the productive. What this resolution about fixed meal time is doing, in a way, is that they're not saying that we'll not cook. So in a way, they're not completely challenging the gendered idea of domesticity. But what they're challenging is that they're asking, or they're demanding, that the domestic and the care and the nurture work is recognized as work, as labor. And it's something that we are talking about now increasingly, you know, care work and nurturing work as work and labor. So they are conceptualizing the domestic as a workplace for themselves, where they are demanding, you know, a specific time and time for their own leisure. And this actually extends to the larger, cooperatives that they created, like the Hippini Bharal or the weaving cooperatives. Weaving, as we know, in Assam, is a gendered activity, right? I mean, in mainstream India, weaving, by definition, is a caste work. Weaver is a particular caste. In Assam and parts of Northeast, weaving is gendered. You know, the Ahomya terms, Hippini and Boni, are both gendered terms. They are, by definition, female weaver. So when they established this Hippini Bharal 1928 onwards across Mohila committees, what were they doing? They were basically getting these weaving material, mekhela, sador, gamusa, etc., being woven by women at home, you know, as part of domestic cottage industry product, and were selling through these weaving cooperatives. And this challenged the entire discourse in khadi. And, you know, if you have time, then I could just quickly mention that the khadi kind of put the discourse of weaving in the discourse of seva. So for Mahatma Gandhi, for instance, it was an act of seva, right? But the Mohila Committee, because they were so entrenched in the weaving cooperative, by 1947-48, they were actually critiquing the central government for changing the policy and changing the policies around yarn distribution and thread distribution. And they said that this is threatening the weaving cooperativism. So they were not looking at weaving only as a discourse of seva, as part of quote-unquote khadi. Though, of course, they got legitimacy because of the movement around khadi. They were thinking of weaving more as a place for kind of breaking the dichotomy of the productive and the reproductive. So where the home was no longer just a space for the reproductive, and the home was both a space for the reproductive as well as for the productive, you know, through the Hippini Bharal, through fixed meal time. So I believe that if we use the prism of gender, it does alert us to these alternative understandings of the public, which otherwise would be blind towards, right?
Right. Again, you're very beautifully in detail explained the interrelationship. Let me ask you about how the Mahila Samitis intersect with other identities like caste and tribe.
Oh, that is a very interesting, part itself, and I'm fascinated because so there are completely diverse threads, and sometimes contradictory threads. Now, before I talk about tribe and caste and Mohila Committee, let's understand that, unlike mainstream India, the caste question is a little complex, and I talk about this in the fourth chapter of the novel, sorry, of the book. And there are two major threads, as far as I understand, regarding tribe-caste relationship and its understanding in Assam. One, which is kind of mainly argued by Sanjeev Borua and others, that caste is a relatively open category in Assam. Like, that's what Sanjeev Borua says. Now, Debabrata Sharma and others have, of course, said that caste may have been open. However, we must recognize that indigenous and tribal communities have always been, he uses the term Janajati and Janagosti, they have remained marginal to the nationalist formation in Assam. Now, we know specific examples, right? That the Barpeta Kirtan Ghar, for instance, where women are not allowed to this state. To men, the Kirtan Ghar opened its door to men of all castes only as late as 1947, right? Similarly, the Hajo Madhav Temple, the Mohila Committee, actually Assam Mohila Committee, and by that time it had renamed itself as Assam Pradeshik Mohila Committee in 1945. So the Assam Pradeshik Mohila Committee actually led a campaign for all caste entry into the Hajo Madhav Temple, and they were successful. Of course, we fail to recognize these interventions that the Mohila Committees did. Chandraprabha Hoykani was an early advocate of the caste question in Assam. She was what they called it at the time, Horijan Andolan. She was at the forefront of the Horijan Andolan, or the backward caste movement in Assam in the 1930s and 40s. She met Gandhi. She also had a critique of Gandhi's understanding of the idea of the Horijan, because she felt that in her talk that he fully didn't grasp the kind of complexities, because she was the one who actually led small but meaningful mobilizations, like lower caste people's entry into Hotra, or access to Hotra wells, kuas, water sources. So that is one part of the story. The other part of the story, which is intriguing, is that in 1930, Chandraprabha Hoykani publishes this in Abahan, which is another Ahomya periodical, her presidential address to the Assam Kosari Mohila Hanmiloni. Now, it is very interesting that Mohila committees usually are organized around localities or towns. For instance, you'd have a Tezpur Mohila Committee, Naugaon Mohila Committee, Guwahati, Kamrup, this and that. To have a Mohila Committee around a particular tribal, indigenous, or caste group was unique. But we have to remember that this is also the time where you have other, so the just as the Assam Sahitya Sabha was patronizing the Assam Mohila Committee, there was the Assam Sutiya Hanmiloni, Assam Koibortho Hanmiloni, and they were also, quote unquote, mobilizing their own women and celebrating Hoti Hadhoni Utsav, Radhika Utsav. So the separation of the tribal and the Ahomya was, I believe, quite well entrenched. In fact, I'd just like to give an example from the 1948 Assam Pradeshik Mohila Committee's annual conference. Now, by 1947-48, Assam state had decided that the state language of Assam should be Assamese, and it's because it was a larger Assam, right? At that time, Assam included parts of major states like Meghalaya, Arunachal, and parts of other states. And Bonelli Kongmen, who was a member of the Legislative Assembly at the time and who was from Shillong, She pointed out that, and I quote, it is futile to try and impose a language on anyone. She just mildly spoke, I believe. You know, this is what the report says. But she was completely outnumbered by, you know, the prevalent, I believe, the majority of Khmer women. And they went ahead with this idea that, yes, Assamese should be the language, the state language. Now, I'm not suggesting that the Assam Pradeshik Mohila Committee at this stage in 48 had the wherewithal or the power to kind of decide which should be the state language. But what I'm trying to indicate is that they're working in collusion with this majority of Khmer understanding of imposing the Khmer language on indigenous and tribal communities. And I believe that is one of the indicators of the kind of rift that continued even within the Mohila Committee. So I've talked about this a little bit in the third chapter, you know, in a section called Constituents of the Collective. So who were the women who were part of the collective and who always remained kind of on its margin? So Women's Association has its own you know, logistics and so to say, rationale for who would be included and who would be excluded. Yes.
Interesting. So could you also comment on the role of the vernacular publics in colonial Assam?
Yes, like, first of all, we you know, understand that vernacular publics are mostly constituted, particularly in the colonial time, in the 1920s and 30s, through print culture, right? So literary associations, political associations, like I mentioned, Sutiya Honmiloni, then All Assam, Koiboto Honmiloni, Kolita Jatiya Honmilon. So there are numerous associations and that were functioning in the public sphere in Assam at that point, and all of them were, and Shekhar Bandyopadhyay in the context of Bengal has actually talked about it, how the census, in a way, created this room for more and more, you know, communities carving a separate identity for themselves. The census was kind of a reference point for many of these associations and, you know, communities to come together. So it was a very, very vibrant and a complex public sphere, I would say, in the 1920s and 30s, Assam, because of all these multiple and different stakeholders, so to say. So like in the beginning when I mentioned that the book explores the gendered public, but it does gesture towards all these multiple publics. That's what I meant, that it's such a complex and rich, you know, diversity that you see. If you read the newspaper, Ohomia, you know, the weekly, or the Tindinya Ohomia, one immediately gets a sense of that milieu, which is so very diverse and complex. And I'm fascinated, and I hope that, you know, more work would be, you know, coming forward. I mean, more researchers would be coming forward to explore this complexity and diversity. I think we need, we're still kind of scratching, you know, the very top layer of that complexity, where we can just, you know, the palimpsest is just kind of unfolding, where we can glean that there are so many other layers. So I'm really fascinated by your own work, for instance, on, you know, the mobile theater and public sphere, and some of the other, you know, contemporaries who are working on Jaita Sharma or Jiti Hoikya, you know, Sanjay Barbara and Rakhi Kulta Moral, and, you know, everyone exploring a different facet of the public. So I hope that I have, you know, kind of given a glimpse of that complexity, but of course the book's rationale is not to kind of explore it in its entirety. Yes.
Right. Again, thank you so much. I understand that. Lastly, please talk a little bit about the structure of the book for the benefit of our listeners.
Okay, so the book Gendered Publics, Chandra Prabha Hoikiani and the Mohila Committees in Colonial Assam, it begins with a chronology of events in Chandra Prabha, which is mainly about the major events in South Asia at that time and in the life and times of Chandra Prabha Hoikiani and the Mohila Committees. So after that, I have an introduction which tries to kind of conceptualize the idea of the gendered public. So now, you know, with so I don't want to rehash all the work on public sphere, you know, Habermas and Anderson and Joan Scott. And we understand that the public, whatever public we talk about, is always and already gendered. So there is, you know, that understanding is very, very already rooted and kind of proved. So this is where I believe that the conceptual category of the gendered public may be helpful, because I believe that to understand how identities across the gender and sexuality spectrum may orchestrate discursive tools to articulate agendas that challenge and subvert and restructure the already gendered template of a dominant public at any given historical moment, I would like to call that as a gendered public. So unlike the public that is always and already gendered, gendered publics are imaginatively and constantly engaged in restructuring its contours. And it is through this constant theory praxis dyad that gendered publics emerge and thrive. So that is the conceptual category that I'm working with. And that's what I kind of propose in the introduction. Then there's a first chapter which talks about the making of the ideal. So the ideal is by definition a respectable Oromia woman. And I argue that in the 19th century, notions about gender and conjugal relations shifted across diverse texts in Assam. So for instance, in writings of Oromia intelligentsia, colonial land records, judicial papers, women's life writing and memory work, we have a diverse work that all refer going back to gender and conjugal relation. And there is the delineation of a new Oromia woman, the ideal. And this ideal is separated from earlier conceptualizations of her relationship with land, her relationship with other tribal women, and so on and so forth. And she is now conceptualized as this ideal woman in separation from some of these others, quote unquote others, for instance, in opposition to the Bengali Bhadra Mohila, in opposition to the Hirata and the tribal woman, and the Kulioni, Kulioni meaning the female Kuli. So this is an interesting moment where the Oromia nationalist understanding is being shaped through the creation of a unique Oromia identity through the ideal. So there is an attempt to dress her up in the Mekhela Sador, and there are a huge amount of material that I have looked at, and how a new woman was constituted who has to be now seen as separated from the sari clad Bengali Bhadra Mohila or the Methoni Mara tribal woman or the Kulioni, right? So clothing become an important markers of how we are going to visualize this new woman. So the first chapter basically lays the ground for what is the context in which the Mohila Hamitis are emerging, and where are they emerging from? The second chapter talks about this particular expressive tradition called the Nam Kirtan practice. Now, the Nam Kirtan is a Vaishnava practice, and it is rooted among the Vaishnavas in the Brahmaputra Valley. So one immediate concern would be that then if Mohila Hamitis are sourcing from the Nam Kirtan tradition, if early women writers are sourcing from the Nam Kirtan tradition, then they are definitely locating themselves in a particular community space, right? And that is very true. And I'm conscious of that baggage of the community location. However, because in most early Mohila Hamiti meetings, the address marker was I Hokol. Now, I Hokol is a specific term, I meaning mother, and Hokol is a plural marker. Is a specific term that is used in the Nam Kirtan context. So I also felt that if I did not engage with the Nam Kirtan as a methodological tool, then I would be denying these organic linkages that these women were claiming. And for the quote-unquote secular gaze of my time, I would not be actually exploring what was happening in 100 years back. So the argument that I make in the chapter is that There are two things in which colonial, you know, access to modernity and education is being seen as. For instance, that women's access to modernity in colonial South Asia is often predicated on her access to secular education. And parallelly, Kumkum Sangari and Sumantra Banerjee has talked about it, that there is an increasing annihilation and censorship and controlling of women's earlier practices or performance traditions, right? The Nakatiya and others. Now, I could put these two arguments together and see that how the women in the Mohila committees were sourcing actually a vibrant traditional space like the Namkirtan in order to use it as a passport to the new and modern public sphere. So it's a critique of the conventional understanding of the public, which is always predicated on modern public education. And it's also a critique of that women's traditional practices always are under attack and being controlled. Where women, so there is a kind of a gazing from the other side of the telescope, where women use these traditions in order to create a new template, you know, where they actually acknowledge the possibility that new publics could be created and modern publics could be shaped with a conceptual continuation of the traditional public like the Namkirtan. Now, the third chapter, Puharir Mel, which is called, and I've really mostly given examples for the third chapter, for instance, the major movements that define the Mohila committees, the extent of the Mohila committees, the kind of attacks they faced, you know, the Sardayak controversy, the fixed meal time. Now, it's very interesting that they were actually called rightful resident of Tejpur, because Tejpur has this mental health institution. So when women tried to fix meal time, some of the newspaper articles called them meaning crazy. So the fourth chapter is about the weaving cooperatives, which I've talked about briefly, about how women used the khadi ideology, but used it to create an alternative understanding of how they wanted to utilize the trope of weaving in order to claim a role in the public and in the polity. And that is a vision that I believe increasingly we are losing out. And the fifth chapter refers to Chandraprabha Hoikyani's writings. And like I mentioned about her, you know, reference to Kambho, which is, you know, I'm sure would have scandalized many people when, you know, she was writing it in 1921, 100 years ago, a woman, young woman, still unmarried, talking about Kambho. There's this poem that I want to read from her, a later poem, which is called Hurpanakha, Surpanakha. And this is a translation, Free and Fearless Surpanakha. This is a 1958 poem. Free and Fearless Surpanakha, the dearest sister of Ravana Raja, single and happy, lives life carefree, travels the mountains, treads the forests, North Pole, South Pole, within her reach, wanders she, the unfettered woman, no fear in her mind, nor anxiety ridden. So I was fascinated that nowadays, you know, post-1980s, of course, they're increasingly talking about feminist fables and rewriting of mythology from a feminist perspective. And because this poem remained hidden in one of her manuscripts, and, you know, nobody really bothered to we didn't go back to her and to our foremothers. It remained hidden there. And I was fascinated that how she took this character, Surpanakha, who is always, categorized within the, you know, figure of the Rakshasini. And she broke that Aryan Rakshas binary, so to say, to imagine Surpanakha as this free and fearless. I mean, everything about Surpanakha here, single and happy, lives life carefree. So there are so many examples from her writing, which, is fascinating. And I'm sure the fifth chapter, the readers, interested readers would really find examples like that. Then there's a conclusion, and there is almost like an appendix called Curating Memories, an archive of select Mohila committees in Assam, after the conclusion. Now, like I mentioned, we made a short film on the basis of the footage of the archive that we created. And I say this, I wanted to make that a part of the book, but there were two schools of thought that it's an academic work and the film doesn't, and all of that. So I have mentioned some of those dilemma of creating that archive and what does it mean to, you know, what are the contingencies of creating an archive in that particular, it's a small section called Curating Memories. And then there is a section on the representative bibliography of Chandraprabha Khoikiani. She's often remembered as a woman worker, a social worker. Her writings have remained scattered and we are trying to compile it now, but it, you know, even her biographies, most of her biographies don't indicate that she had such a huge corpus of writing. So I've tried to just offer a, you know, select bibliography of her. And then what I'm particularly thrilled is that there is a translation of one of her speeches. So this is the Assam Kasari Mohila Sammelanor Pratham Adhibeshanor Sabhanetrir Abhibhashan. So presidential address to the first Assam Kasari Women's Conference. The term Kasari is of course no longer used. The preferred term is Boro, but because to remain true to the historical document, that's a term I had to retain. And I've mentioned this, you know, earlier about her negotiation with the Kasari Women's Conference. So, and then there's of course a select glossary and bibliography. Yes, so that's about it.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Hemjyoti, for detailing the structure of the book, as well as for talking to me in such great historical as well as cultural and literary detail about your book. I really, really enjoyed listening to you speak. And I hope that our listeners too do and pick up a copy of the book. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.